Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. Some tragic news over the weekend. I took time to look at all the victims of the synagogue massacre because I feel like I owe that to them. A lot of hate going on in the world, and terrorism expert and professor of history at DePaul University, Tom Mikaitis, joins us today. Thank you for being with us, Tom.
Good afternoon. Good morning.
Whatever it is.
It's been a rough several days, Tom. Wendy just said she did. I often find myself doing, too, when there's a tragedy. You hear a number that X amount of people died during a tragedy, and you get very sad and emotional about it. But when you read those personal stories, then it really sinks in, doesn't it?
It certainly does, and that's why they've always said, you know, one death is a tragedy, a thousand is a statistic. But if we remind ourselves that behind the numbers there are always these powerful personal stories, then I think it can draw us together. And that's where I take great hope, is the tremendous outpouring across religious lines of people gathering to say, this is not who we are.
Yeah.
Well, why are we like this then?
Well, I think the thing, I've been doing a lot of research on this for a new book on violent extremism, and there's a long history here. It goes back well into our past to the Ku Klux Klan. It was a resurgence with the Posse Comitatus, the anti-government movement, and the rise of the militias in the 90s. What has changed is, because of our political leadership, what was peripheral has now been legitimized. It has, the white power, white nationalist movement has reinvented itself and dampened down its rhetoric and called it, you know, it's about white pride. It's about, celebrating our European heritage, you know, all this coded racism. And it's no longer, you know, there still, as we saw, the virulently anti-Semitic people, but this has been covered over with a patina of respectability, which has made it okay for people with these extreme views to feel like, you know, they can express them. And then there will always be those who are empowered to act based on that general kind of atmosphere.
What went on? Cesar Sayak is the guy who was sending the mail bombs. Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, none of those bombs detonated. What was that all about? What happened there?
Well, again, you know, this is part of what we have here. I mean, clearly, in one definition, he's a lone wolf. He's a disturbed individual. Fortunately, he was not terribly competent. It's amazing to me that you can have, you know, over a dozen bombs and not one of them goes off. But he, too, tapped into the extremist rhetoric when you realize that everybody he targeted was specifically singled out by the president as somebody he vilified and even demonized. We're just fortunate he wasn't very competent.
What do you say to the people who thought that this was concocted by the Democrats? What do you say to these people? Because people truly believe it. And I don't know what to say. I stop conversations mid-conversation now because I don't want to fight with people. But there are a lot of things out there that people truly believe, and it seems preposterous.
But that's also part of this ideological milieu. If you dig down into it, the conspiracy theory is, in fact, very part and parcel of it, too. There's something else very disturbing. Last week I was in Germany doing lectures on extremism, and the comparisons between Germany in 1933 and the United States today are frequently coming up and extremely disturbing. And in both cases, there is this denial of objective reality. There is no such thing as a fact. There is only what the leader asserts to be true, and anything that the leader does not like is by definition false or fake news or not real. And that is why people so readily buy conspiracy theories. The Independent is ran an article today about how there was even a suggestion from the president, or at least there was a suggestion he implied, that even these anti-Semitic outrages are somehow designed to discredit him. I mean, this is an old narrative. Unfortunately, it's the internet makes it much easier to circulate it.
Tom, do you think the White House is handling these situations properly or improperly?
Improperly. It is the role of the president. The president is not just anybody. Words are, I wrote this in the blog post I did recently. Words have tremendous power, and the leader has an obligation to choose them very carefully. When you demonize an opponent, saying he's not, as John McCain said, a decent person I happen to disagree with, but a bad person, you're somewhat, in some ways, putting a target circle on that person's back. And the other thing is, there is this refusal to unequivocally condemn. There is always this, yes, we condemn the attack, strategic pause, but there's evil on both sides. That effort to dilute into some kind of bizarre moral equivalency is a way of deflecting what should be unequivocal condemnation of hateful speech, hateful behavior, and hateful violence.
Professor Tom Mikaitis with us, professor of history at DePaul University, also a terrorism expert. Now let's go to your expertise, history. I'm curious to know if there's been a time in American culture where it's been so divisive as it is now, and how did we get past it, and will we ever get past this?
Yeah, I think, that's, history actually makes me hopeful because we have gotten through it, you know. There was a resurgence of the Klan in the 1920s and 30s. That passed. We saw another resurgence of this kind of extreme divisiveness and violence with the civil rights movement. Do you remember the incredibly hateful language to call-in shows and everything else when Harold Washington was elected mayor of Chicago? Could you imagine even 20 years ago when Matthew Shepard was murdered, that his ashes would be laid to rest in the National Cathedral? That is what gives me hope, that there is this speaking out against constantly, consistently, etc. And I think in those small and great ways, that's how we will get by it.
All right, and this term has been brought up a lot about angry white men, and I don't want to invalidate people's feelings of insecurity, but why is this happening? What are they scared? How does this happen?
You know, terrorism rests on a grievance narrative and an empowerment narrative. The grievance narrative here is this perception based on very little evidence. If you look at the power structures in the country, 70% of Congress is male, that if you're a straight, white, male, Christian, you're somehow an endangered species in the absence of any kind of evidence. And then, of course, when you have a politician who comes along and gives you the other half, the empowerment narrative, that's how you get Charlottesville. Anyone who looks at the world around them, you know, and says, looks at the Kavanaugh hearings and says, boy, it's really hard to be, to be a man today, a white man today. Well, you know, his confirmation hardly supports that. But that narrative is very powerful. You see, if there's anything wrong with my life, particularly, you know, if I'm white, working class, at the bottom of the social ladder, not terribly well educated, at least in the old days, there were people of color I could look down on, and I kept my women in line. I mean, the connection between the misogyny, the anti-Semitism, the racism is very, very powerful. It's a toxic swirl. It's a very toxic mix.
Tom Mikaitis is our guest, professor of history at DePaul University, terrorism expert. If you have any questions or comments for Tom or for us, we're at 312-981-7200. We'll pick it up in just a moment. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. Our guest is Tom Mikaitis. Tom is a professor of history at DePaul University and a terrorism expert. Tom, one of the things that these two guys had in common, so you had Caesar Sayak, that's the mail bomber, and Robert Bowers, who shot up the synagogue in Pittsburgh, is that they were both extremely disenfranchised citizens, both loners. In this day and age where the internet makes it very easy for people of like mind to connect with each other, what kept these men as loners?
The internet is a very disturbing thing. We've seen this kind of phenomenon with both the Islamist extremists and the far right, is the internet is both isolating and validating. In other words, you lose touch with the reality around you, the ability to look your neighbor in the eye and realize this is another human being, because you are enmeshed in a virtual community that validates, reinforces in an echo chamber, the extremist views that you put out there. And, you know, that you're always going to have these disturbed individuals. I mean, there is often a social pathology to the background. Most are not diagnosably, you know, mentally ill. But again, when the atmosphere of mainstream political discourse becomes so toxic, it's a stimulant for these people. It encourages them. And again, the conspiracy theory, everyone's saying, you know, screw the optics, I'm going in. What they leave out of that quote is what was immediately before it, is I'm not going to stand by and watch my people be slaughtered. Now, where does that come from? Where is this threat that he perceives that white people are somehow in grave danger? But he did. He genuinely believed it and he acted on it.
I don't understand how white people can feel so vulnerable. I really don't understand it.
Well, it's a subset of the whole. And what they do is they take a look at, first of all, they're getting their news. This is one of the concerns from people, from outlets that just reinforce the same kind of thinking. And as I said, you know, there's no question there's been economic dislocation in the working class. We've seen union decline. We've seen the whole nine yards, et cetera. But on the other hand, that is due to long-term economic structural kinds of things, not any conspiracy. Not anybody coming here to take away their jobs. Coal mining was declining, you know, and has continued. Even the new factory with Carrier is largely robotics. That's just the reality. But if somebody comes along and tells you that, you know what, it's really not your fault. It's all about these other people. And if we could just get rid of them, you would be so much better off. So whatever is wrong with your life, you can just heap it on the back of whatever the scapegoat of the month happens to be.
All right, and these people that do these heinous crimes, do these people do it for fame, or is this just something they truly believe in their hearts that they need to accomplish?
I think it's a combination. I think there is an element of desiring martyrdom for the cause, although this individual was not willing to die. Obviously, he surrendered. But, you know, they do believe they're making a statement for the cause. And again, yeah, they get national notoriety. You know, and that in some way validates them, you know, where they feel unempowered. Now suddenly they've gone from being nobody to being somebody.
Did they think they would get away with it in either of these cases, Tom, or does that not even enter into the equation?
Oh, I think they clearly thought they could get away with it. I mean, the individual went in heavily armed in the case of the synagogue. It's a little bit less clear in the case of the bomber. You know, is it possible he was trying to scare everybody? As I said, it's really unusual to have no device go off. And this guy was not, you know, the brightest bulb in the chandelier. The idea that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton open their own mail is,
right.
You know, I mean, their security is much better than that. But
he really was built, though. He really was in great shape.
Yeah, whatever.
Well, I know, and that had been talked about, too, that perhaps steroids were used because he was humongous.
Yeah.
And that.
Well, there's also this, the piece of the puzzle there is, there's a lot of discussion, you know, even on our campuses, what we call toxic masculinity, which is this, you know, kind of machismo thing that goes with this disempowerment narrative and how, you know, we white males have to fight back and this kind of, you know, so-called radical feminism is one of the hot buttons as well. But in his case, you know, this is anybody who criticized Trump. And again, the coded racism is really interesting. You get, you know, the president tweeting against Soros being targeted. Soros is Jewish. But that gets left out, and that's part of that coding. That's part of that covert kind of coded racism and anti-Semitism that we don't, you know, that makes it just a little bit more legitimate than it would otherwise be.
What do you say to people who say this level of racism has always existed, but now with the current temperature in the White House, it's been okay to admit that you're a racist? What do you say to that?
I think there's an element of truth to that, except that they will still emphatically deny that they're racist. They will say it's about white pride. That's the cleverness of the rhetoric. It's very interesting, and I spent a lot of time looking at these websites, which is like wading through a sewer. But essentially, the sites themselves often have a certain tameness to them. But then you go to their Facebook page, and you see what they allow by way of the people who sign on and blog with them, and their main blogs are password protected now. You know, they're on Reddit, they're in the dark web, or even if they're not, there is a password protection because they're very aware. They learn from what happened in the 90s, they're afraid of infiltrators and so on. So, you know, it gets hard to monitor this. And one of the hardest things is to get, even the Southern Poverty Law Center, and I communicated with them, can't give you precise numbers on how many people belong to these groups because it is so, there's such a spider web of hatred out there.
And after the mail bombs were all in the news and everything, do you think this I don't know if inspire is the correct term, but this Pittsburgh murderer would have done it anyway, but did it maybe inspire him to do it at this time?
You know, there is this phenomenon they sometimes call the psych ward effect, where an unstable person is set off by the instability of somebody else. There is a possibility that he was, for lack of a better term, inspired by the bomb plot, or something else snapped. I mean, there's always an element of the personal and the idiosyncratic in it. But on the other hand, you know, it's not clear the targeting would have unfolded in this way, and it's not clear it would have snapped entirely either. You know, it's interesting that people always treat somebody who's withdrawn and a loner and, you know, as though that they're surprised that they act out. That actually is in some ways a symptom.
Tom, we have 10 seconds, 20 seconds, but I'm curious about this. Once there was a pattern developing that George Soros got a letter, that the Clintons got a letter, that the Obamas got a letter, does the FBI or somebody put together a list of potential danger spots and say, well, if they got a letter, we got to keep an eye on these people too?
Yeah, they actually do. Profiling and pattern analysis is enormously important in terms of countering terrorism. And then you can't cover everybody. So what you then do is issue a generic kind of warning. I mean, you probably at your own radio station have got to have in place some kind of protocols for screening and for situational awareness. I mean, every media outlet now has to pay attention to that. But you know, if I can end, you know, you always say that I'm on the positive side. You know,
the human Prozac. That's what you
try hard. The outpouring of sympathy and support across religious, racial, ethnic lines and the statements of solidarity, really, that's what we cling to. I really do think we're going to get through this dark period.
I hope you're right, Tom. I do.
He's the human Prozac, I swear to God. You make us feel better every time we speak to you with the crazy things going on in this world we live in right now. Thank you so much.
That is Tom Mikaitis.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Professor of History at DePaul University and terrorism expert.
Where's your blog? Can I just ask you that?
Yeah, Tom, where is it?
Yeah, the best place is just through Twitter, at DR, Dr. Mikaitis. It's that simple. You know, at Dr. Mikaitis, and you'll get all the stuff that I've written and the links to it. And so,
and it's the traditional spelling of Mikaitis, Mockaitis.
Yep, with DR in front of it. Yep.
All right, perfect. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
We'll take a quick break. We'll get you some news.
And coming up, the stories that matter with Steve Bertrand from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom, 720 WGN.